It's Philosophy Talk.
Rational thought, my dear friends, is a self-rewarding virtue. And religious prejudice is a veil which protects the mind from reason.
The life and thought of Baruch Spinoza.
One of the most beguiling and influential philosophers of all time.
Spinoza was unappreciated during his lifetime, but widely heralded after his death.
What led Hegel to say that you are either a Spinozaist or not a philosopher at all?
The man's intuitions were astonishing.
Our guest is Rebecca Goldstein, author of Betraying Spinoza, the renegade Jew who gave us modernity.
In so many different fields, in cosmology, in neuroscience, and certainly in philosophy, his intuitions are being vindicated time and time again.
The life and thought of Spinoza, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hi, I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs.
If you're enjoying this episode of Philosophy Talk, won't you consider supporting the show?
Your donation of any size will help us stay on the air and online.
Where we can continue to question everything.
Except your intelligence. And help people think about things differently.
Just go to philosophytalk.org and click donate at the top of the page.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for supporting Philosophy Talk.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner at Stanford. That's where Ken teaches philosophy, and I taught philosophy for 40 years.
40 amazing years, John. Now, today, we're talking about the 17th century Dutch philosopher, Baruch Spinoza, sometimes called the inventor of modernity.
Along with Descartes and Leibniz, Spinoza is one of the great rationalists of the 16th and 17th century.
Yeah, he had a lot in common with those guys, but he was far more radical than either of them, John. For one thing, you know, both Descartes and Leibniz found a place in their thinking, really important places in their thinking, for something very much like the traditional Judeo-Christian God, you know, a personal God, creator of the rest of us, guider of the universe. There is not a single hint of anything like that in Spinoza's kind of atheistic system.
Yeah, but it's not quite fair to call Spinoza an atheist. He was a pantheist, really. Pantheists believe that God is everything and everything is God. If everything is God, then God exists.
Well, okay, but I don't want to quibble over labels. I mean, one thing you have to admit is that Spinoza's God, if you want to call it that, you insist on that label, is very, very different from the Judeo-Christian God. His so-called God is not a transcendent being that exists apart from the world that he supposedly created. That God just is the world, and there's nothing at all beyond it, this world God totality nature thing.
I guess that's precisely what makes some people call Spinoza the inventor of modernity. He both changed the way people in the West think about God and changed the way we think about the universe as a whole, very much including the place of humans within it.
Yeah, I think that's a really important part of Spinoza. Think of the mental and the physical. You know, before Spinoza, many thinkers considered the mental and the physical as radically different things. I would say that was part of common sense. It was part of philosophy. It was a part of everything. Spinoza denied that. He saw the mental and the physical as really like two aspects of one thing, two aspects of a single universe.
And that's just the tip of the universe, so to speak. There are many more than just these two aspects of the one universe. Spinoza's universe is this freestanding, multidimensional thing of boundless complexity. And we poor humans have, so far at least, a very radically incomplete understanding.
Yeah, sounds a lot. If you put it that way, it sounds a lot like modern string theory or something.
And ask yourself where we humans fit into this string of things.
The string of things. Well, I know one thing, not as entities made in the image and likeness of the transcendent God, not as immortal souls and a brief sojourn within the material world, nothing like that, I assume.
No, that's not what we're like at all on Spinoza's view. We're nothing but transient modes or aspects of the one universe. Think of the universe as a vast, deep pond. were ripples in the pond. And like ripples, we don't last very long.
You know, it sounds plausible to me. I bet you it sounds plausible to many people these days. It sounds maybe like common sense, but, you know, I'm sure that it struck Spinoza's contemporaries. It's not plausible at all, but as bold, original.
More like revolutionary and dangerous. He was called Satan's emissary and the great atheist. He was even excommunicated by the Jewish Congregation of Amsterdam for his, quote, monstrous deeds and abominable heresies.
Wow, John, monstrous deeds. You know, the funny thing is, though, I mean, if I recall correctly, he was excommunicated when he was just 23. He was just a pup. Those big books that outline his philosophical system, they came much later, didn't they? Indeed, his most famous book, The Ethics, which he was afraid to publish in his lifetime because he didn't like controversy, that was only published posthumously.
Yeah, but you know how young men in a hurry to change the entire metaphysical, theological, and scientific outlook of the Western world can be.
I haven't met many
big hurry. I bet he was willing to talk about developing versions of his views to anyone who would listen.
Well, you know, I haven't met many young men like that, but whatever exactly he did to so piss off the powers that be in his Sephardic Jewish community, I know one thing. We moderns, we owe him a debt of gratitude.
The gratitude did come a little late for him to know about it, but it did come. In the 19th century, Hegel said you're either a Spinozist or not a philosopher at all. And in the 20th century, Einstein and Borges both wrote love poems to Spinoza.
Wow, love poems to Spinoza. Now, you know, we said in this program once that Leibniz, who actually hated Spinoza, I gather, was the most important philosopher you know the least about. But I'm starting to think we were wrong about that. It's probably Spinoza who deserves that title.
Well, at a minimum, he probably deserves the title of the once most widely reviled philosopher who's now most widely revered.
You know, and to find out more about this once reviled, now revered philosopher, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, to follow the trail of this renegade. She files this report.
By the time Baruch Spinoza was 23 years old, his philosophies had already ruffled a lot of feathers in the Portuguese Jewish community of Amsterdam. He claimed God and nature were the same thing.
He began to question everything.
Everything, creation, and our creator.
That's a clip from Tariq Ali's Spinoza, the Apostle of Reason. On July 27, 1656, the Jewish leaders in Amsterdam issued a cherem on Spinoza, a total exclusion from the Jewish community.
The matter has been carefully examined by the ruling scholars and councils. They consent to the banishment forever of Baruch de Spinoza from the nation of Israel.
The Jewish leaders wrote, "Cursed be he by day, and cursed be he by night. Cursed be he when he lies down, and cursed be he when he rises up. Cursed be he when he goes out, and cursed be he when he comes in." You get the picture.
Yeah, he really pissed somebody off.
That's Stephen Nadler, a philosophy professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a Spinoza expert.
This is by far the harshest cherem ever issued by that community in this period. There were dozens of cherems issued by the Amsterdam community between 1630 and 1680, and they're for a variety of offenses, taking a book out of the library without permission, for insulting the rabbis, for gambling, for lewd behavior in the streets. But usually the cherem was lifted after a short period of time when the offender made an apology and paid a fine.
Spinoza never apologized. At least there's no documentation of it. Even still, people have tried really hard to get Spinoza reintegrated into Judaism.
There was an instance in 1927 when Joseph Klausner, the historian at Hebrew University, stood on a hilltop and proclaimed the ban was lifted. And of course, he had no authority to do that. It didn't mean anything. And then in 1953, David Ben-Gurion, former prime minister of Israel, insisted that the ban should be lifted. But the only authority who could lift the ban would be the leadership of the Amsterdam Portuguese community that issued the ban in the first place.
And they were not going to do that.
But then a couple of years ago, a member of the Portuguese congregation wanted the issue raised again.
That was in 2012. The congregation put together an advisory committee of Spinoza experts to weigh in, including Stephen Nadler. Nadler's takeaway was, what's the point? Spinoza is long dead. It would just be a symbolic move.
The only reason why you would want to lift the cherem is because it would be a kind of public relations boon, kind of proclaiming to the world, Spinoza is one of ours and we welcome him back with open arms.
The 2012 effort to get Spinoza de-excommunicated didn't work, and Nadler thinks that's a good thing. He says reintegrating Spinoza into Judaism would undermine Spinoza's philosophies.
Spinoza no longer saw himself as Jewish, but he didn't see himself as Christian or Muslim or anything. He was an individual who, like all individuals, are part of nature.
Ultimately, we don't know how Spinoza felt about his excommunication because there's no documentation on that. But Nadler thinks Spinoza couldn't have cared less.
For him to be welcomed back into this or that particular religious community, for him would be a meaningless thing. Maybe a betrayal of what Spinoza stands for. He doesn't want to be a member of this club that wants him as a member.
Baruch Spinoza died in The Hague at age 44. He was making a living grinding optical lenses at the time, and the dust from the glass exacerbated an earlier lung illness. In the 20-plus years after his excommunication, Spinoza continued to write philosophical works about the nature of reality, politics, and, of course, religion. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thanks, Shuka, and thanks, Stephen Nadler, for providing those insights into Spinoza's life and relation with the Jewish community. I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today we're thinking about the thought and life and times of Baruch Spinoza. We're joined now by Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein. She was recently awarded a National Humanities Medal by President Barack Obama for bringing philosophy into conversations with culture. She's author of many things, including Betraying Spinoza, The Renegade Jew Who Gave Us Modernity. Rebecca, welcome to Philosophy Talk, and sincere and deep congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much. Hi, John. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Rebecca, and congratulations from me, too. Now, it's certainly no surprise to find you interested in Spinoza, because you're interested in everything interesting. But tell us about how and when you and Spinoza got together for the first time.
Yeah, this is a long relationship. It goes all the way back to when I was a sophomore in high school, and I went to a very religious, orthodox, all-girls school in which we were actually discouraged from even going on to college. This was really, this was hardcore.
I'm glad you recovered from that.
Well, it's an ongoing journey. And I played hooky. I hated that school. But one day I was there, and I was in a Jewish history class, and we were talking about modernity, which we were against, right? And it had all been downhill since Babylonia. And Spinoza was being discussed, and he was being discussed as a cautionary tale. You know, this is what happens, little girls, when you ask too many questions. And for the first time, I actually raised my hand in class and asked a question. It was the first time I was interested. Various things the teacher said. You know, he wasted his good brains that God gave him, and he was, he was a shame for the Jews, and even Christians despised him. But one of the things that she said, this teacher, it determined the course of my life, which was, although he was a heretic, the Jewish word, the Hebrew word for heretic is apikoros, which actually comes from Epicurus, right? Shows the attitude towards philosophers. And he kept it secret until both of his parents died, and he went along with everything.
Ah.
And I vowed to myself at 14 years old that I would do the same, which was mighty inconvenient, I have to say. So I did go along with the conventions of my community until both my parents were gone.
Wow. Geez, your high school teacher must be so proud of having inspired such an important figure. or maybe not. Now, you call Spinoza the renegade Jew. And we just heard facts about his being excommunicated by the Jews of Amsterdam. I guess we don't know quite what they were thinking of. But give us a quick overview of Spinoza's most shocking ideas, the ones that probably ended up his being a renegade.
Well, I mean, there certainly is his view of God, identifying God with nature. He removes any grounds for a transcendent God. It's, you know, it's not just that he's arguing for the identity between God and nature. And what he means by nature is basically a final theory of everything, the kind of thing that string theorists talk about. But I think the thing that really made him so dangerous, that he was appropriating for reason the tasks that had been taken over, that religion had delegated to itself, namely to explain why there's something rather than nothing, you know, how existence came to be, and what is the nature of morality, and why ought we to be moral. And he was cutting, Judeo-Christian God out of the picture.
Well, so look, we're going to have to dig into this. This is deep, complicated, big, exciting stuff, but we'll come back to it after a short break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about Spinoza with Rebecca Goldstein, author of Betraying Spinoza.
In our next segment, we'll look at how this renegade philosopher ushered in modernity.
Monism, multiple aspects, and modernism when Philosophy Talk continues.
Who's got the last laugh? He, let's at the past laugh. Ha, ha, ha. Who's got the last laugh now?
Baruch Spinoza had some pretty wild ideas for a guy in the 17th century in Amsterdam. And his fellow Jewish community didn't laugh that hard. They gave him a writ of harem, basically an excommunication. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're looking at the life and thought of Spinoza.
Our guest is Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, author of Betraying Spinoza, the Renegade Jew Who Gave Us Modernity.
So, Rebecca, I want to ask you about this. You're not the only person who's... I heard Dan Garber, who was on the show, said Spinoza invented modernity. You say he's the renegade Jew who gave us modernity. Really? Single-handedly? One guy? How did he give us modernity? Help me think about what it means to say Spinoza gave us modernity.
Yeah. He did have helpers. I would say he seeded the Enlightenment, that he's really, you know, about 100 years before these ideas take off, that the big questions can be answered by way of reason. Reason can be, you know, can give us the world, and it can give us the oughts, right? He's the first to naturalize normativity, or to try to naturalize normativity. I mean, he calls his magnum opus the Ethics, and actually reading that book does change you. It's you're never quite the same again.
Yeah, it's exhausting, but it's fascinating too.
You know, I used to teach it every autumn. And it was a small, intense class. And by Thanksgiving, they were Spinozas, and it was an extraordinary thing that would happen. I don't know how it lasted.
Okay, let's try it this way. Okay, yeah. So I know that Spinoza struck just about every thinker of the time, not just the religious thinkers, but many philosophers, as deeply problematic in some ways. I mean, Leibniz, who was deeply influenced by Spinoza, mm-hmm. thought he wrote this pitiful book. I forget the exact phrase he used, but he thought, too bad he couldn't have written a better book. Such a brilliant man, right? But, okay, think me back into the pre-modern frame of reference. What is it about pre-modernity, and what was so prevalent about pre-modernity that he challenged so deeply?
So the book that Leibniz was attacking was the Theological Political Treatise, not the Ethics.
Right.
And he called it, a pestilent book or pestilent book. So what was going on there? Well, Spinoza was saying that, the subtitle of that book says a great deal, wherein it is shown that freedom to philosophize can not only be granted without injury to piety and the peace of the commonwealth, But that the peace of the Commonwealth and piety are endangered by the suppression of this freedom. He was trying to get the clerics, first and foremost, but also the state, out of philosophy's way. And by philosophy, he also meant natural philosophy, he meant science. So this idea that there are experts in thinking and everybody else should get out of the way, including the religious thinkers, was heresy. This was a renegade.
So his renegadism isn't just in this new conception of God and diminished conception of humans, but also in this advocacy of something like free speech well before its time.
Free speech, free inquiry, exactly.
Now Locke spent some time in Holland. And then, came back with William and Mary, and kind of that gave a boost to free speech. Is there any connection between these two Holland-based phenomena?
Some of us think so. So, Locke and Spinoza were born exactly the same year, 1632, although Spinoza died much, sooner.
Yeah.
When Locke spent his time in Amsterdam, which he had to go to. It was the freest state in all of Europe, the freest place in all of Europe. When he went there, he had certain ideas. He spoke to people who had known Spinoza. And all we know is that when he left Amsterdam, he was far closer to what we call modernity. Certainly, that's when he wrote the two letters of toleration, mm-hmm. Of tolerance. He was moving much closer to this notion of free inquiry and get out of the way.
So here's the thing. I guess strikes me. The some of the ideas in people like Locke and Spinoza and others seem to us these days just like common sense, and probably like they were always there. Right. But actually, that's not true. They emerged at a time, in a place. And one of the reasons I think it's really cool to study these dead philosophers is because you can actually see new cultural formations actually emerging in the thought of these people. And one of the things we don't get is how radical, how much of a rupture these ideas are from what was prevailing at the time. Do you agree with that or disagree with that?
So very much agree. One of the things that's very telling about him is that after he was put into permanent harem, the one and only person we know who was put into permanent harem by his Jewish community, he didn't convert to Christianity, although that would have been such a good career move, right, to convert to Christianity. He's the first person that we know of the modern age who refuses to identify himself in terms of a religious community. So he was insisting on a secular identity at a time when the notion of secularism didn't even exist. It hadn't been formulated yet. So, think about that in terms of what a revolutionary he was.
So the Jewish community in Amsterdam didn't like what he had to say, but the wider Amsterdam community, which I suppose was mostly Christian, were his ideas on the political sphere. I'm sure his ideas on God and humans were quite at variance with their views, but was his view on political freedom and freedom of speech, was that as grating to the wider citizens of Amsterdam as it would have been to the Jewish community?
Well, Amsterdam was the freest place in all of Europe. They had many bookshops, which were gathering places for thinkers all over Europe. I mean, Descartes also went and found refuge in Amsterdam. So in fact, the one external identity that Spinoza did apply to himself and with great pride was as a citizen of the Republic of the Netherlands. That he took pride in. It's the only place where he could have gotten away with what he did get away with.
So I've heard a couple different things here. So Spinoza was one of the founding fathers of political modernity, of a kind of political conception of the state, of the importance of the separation of church and state. Mm-hmm. I've heard it said, I mean, because of his naturalism, right, there is nothing beyond nature. Nature is a complete thing unto itself, you know, governed by the laws of nature, relentless necessity. He was among the first or the first or something to think that thought in a thick way, which has really big consequences. Because if you think, well, what is the human being? Well, some part of nature. How do we understand the human being in nature? And that seemed like one of his major goals. You have to have a naturalistic approach. You have to think of consciousness and will and freedom as just things in the natural. That's not an easy... We're still struggling with that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. I've heard it said that he's, you know, people like Einstein... Because of his theory of everything kind of approach, thought he was cool. So, I mean, he was the inventor of, like, it sounds like he ushered in all many, many different aspects of modernity. Political modernity, scientific modernity, philosophical modernity. Would you agree with that?
I would, and ethical modernity as well, right? The notion of naturalizing ethics, of trying to derive it from a study of humans, of human nature.
Okay, so I want you to convince me. I mean, so tell me, how did the pre-moderns think of, say, ethics? Was there no hint of naturalistic ethics or naturalistic psychology in the pre-moderns?
Well, there certainly was in the Greek world, right? So, you know, Aristotle, his notions of human flourishing. But once Europe became Christianized, that realm of thinking was taken over by the church and synagogue, you know, and mosque. And so it was, it had been a long time since philosophers, philosophers took up the broken thread from the Greeks.
So let me ask you a question. Okay, so once you make this shift to thinking about human beings as just part of nature, and what happens to ethics? I mean, some people think, Dostoevsky said, if God is dead, everything is permitted and nothing is forbidden, right? Anything goes, and lots of people live in that fear. Nietzsche in the 19th century announced the death of God and thought that ethics was a big problem. How did Spinoza think we ought to live, given this this radical shift in outlook that he was ushering in?
So I can start at the beginning, or I can start at the end.
Where you end up.
Okay. So the fundamental notion in his psychology, and therefore also in his ethics, is conatus, right? The striving. So it comes from the Latin to strive, to try. The striving to persist in our own survival and flourishing. And he said he actually identifies that as the essence of a thing. What I am, what Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein is the thing that cares more about the survival and flourishing of Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein than anything else, right? And that, and it doesn't even call for any explanation why I care about it. I'm that thing, and that's why I care about it. That is his fundamental idea here, and a very, you know, naturalist right. idea. It could be nicely supported by evolutionary psychology.
Right, I just had that same thought. Yeah.
So, you know, there are ways in which we could really bolster this up now and make it give it even more scientific respectability. But what he, that's where all the auths come from, you know, our own self-interest. And what he tries to argue, though, is that if we're rational about it, we will end up caring about the universe at large, seeing ourselves in the widest perspective possible, caring about other people, seeing that they're exactly in the same position as we are. He does derive something like the golden rule. But the end point is this point of sort of great acceptance, acquiescence, gratitude that you're part of existence, even for a short time. And it's a very elevated, transcendent kind of experience that you can get into when you give yourself over to his reasoning.
So Rebecca, we've got an interesting question in email from Joanne in San Francisco. It's a little off the topic when pursuing, but it's very interesting. She wants to know what Spinoza thought of the Torah. That's the first five books of Moses in the Old Testament. I assume something quite different than he was taught as a sophomore in high school, but what did he think of
it? So, yeah, so here's another way in which he's, you know, driving us into modernity. He's really the first person who put forth a consistent, rigorous biblical criticism. He's the first person that we know of who said that the Torah was written by many different authors spread out over different time frames. He points out the internal inconsistencies of it. He thinks, you know, that there was a collator. He thinks it was actually Ezra. During the return of from Babylonia. But anyway, so that's another thing. And one of the things that he talks about in biblical criticism is that you have to, you know, you have to read it internally. You can't try to interpret it with your conception of truth. And that way, he's very, very against Maimonides. But that you have to see what it's trying to say internally. And if you read it that way, you'll find many different inconsistencies.
Well, so some philosopher, I can't remember who said, criticizing Spinoza said, and philosophy says, that if you're a consistent philosopher, you have to be a Spinozaist. I wasn't Hegel who thought that was a praise, but so do you remember this?
So I think during Hegel's time, in the midst of the German Enlightenment, the Aufklärung, there was this guy named Jacobi, and he was a convert from Judaism to Christianity, and he decided to mount a huge argument with the Aufklärung, with the Enlightenment, making Spinoza the center boy, the poster boy. And he was the one who said, look, if you are a consistent philosopher, you are an atheist, a Spinozist, an immoralist, a fatalist. And he even accused Kant of being a closet Spinozist.
Yeah. So you could think of Spinoza's philosophy, and either that's a good thing for philosophy or a bad thing for philosophy. But we'll dig into more of this. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about Spinoza with Rebecca Goldstein, author of Betraying Spinoza.
In our next segment, we'll compare Spinoza's revolutionary metaphysics with some ideas of the universe offered by modern science.
Many aspects, many universes, and many interpretations when Philosophy Talk continues.
Today we're thinking about Baruch Spinoza. He didn't accept a lot of the wisdom of his time, especially the Judeo-Christian concept of God. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence, and not surprisingly, I'm Ken Taylor, and our guest is Rebecca Neuberger-Goldstein.
So, Rebecca, your book says Betraying Spinoza, and I think it's you, the author, that you claim is betraying Spinoza, not uniquely. Can you tell us why you're betraying Spinoza?
There are so many ways in which I betrayed Spinoza in that book. One was that it was written in a series. I had been invited to write on a series of Jewish thinkers confronting Jewish thinkers. And when the editor approached me, I said, I'm really not interested. The only person I would be interested in writing about would be Baruch Spinoza. But to write about him from a Jewish point of view is such a betrayal of Spinoza. And I was so impassioned in my, arguing that I couldn't do it, I wouldn't do it, that he said, wow, you should do this. There's a lot of passion here. And I was really glad I did, because actually looking at Spinoza in the context of his Jewish history, his community, gave me actually new insights into even the ethics. I read it a little bit differently.
But it's not, I want to explore. I know there's another sense, but I want to explore. I'm going to stop you there for a second, because here's one of the things I have come to think. I'm not sure I get Spinoza right about this. I mean, he doesn't address postmodernity and identity politics and the formation of a human identity, but I think he would think that all these concrete specific identities that we have, that we take so seriously, just are not worth taking seriously. They're not worthy of reason. They divide us in ways that don't that we shouldn't be divided. They speak to us with the authority of a tradition, but where does the authority of a tradition come from? So I don't know. I think that underneath him is some kind of thoroughgoing cosmopolitanism that would reject all these concrete, particular local identity formations. Am I right or wrong about that?
If anything, that's the heart of Spinoza. There's a way of reading the Ethics as a kind of how-to book, how to form, how to construct a different identity, throwing off all of those contingent markers, the group that we happen to have been born into. And here's, you know, he's so radical that he's sort of arguing to the extent that we're rational, we all participate in exactly the same identity.
Right.
It's the only identity that matters.
So to map him as a Jewish slinker,
he's like,
wow,
a
Rebecca.
Betrayal, right? Yeah, right. It was But one of the things I sort of argued myself into was that community. That community was very, very special. It was a very fraught community. It consisted of refugees from the Inquisition, they were Portuguese refugees. They were all, they had been converts because, you know, Judaism was illegal on the Iberian Peninsula. Start, you know, 1492 in Spain, and then 1497, it was the Inquisition came to Portugal. And so his entire community was reclaiming Judaism. They had been, you know, a lot of them secret Jews at great peril to themselves. That's what the auto de fe was all about, rooting out these secret Jews. And so their Jewish identity meant everything to them. And they were always arguing about what is it really to be a Jew? Are there relatives who are back in Portugal who are practicing Catholicism? Are they yet Jewish? And I think that that pushed Spinoza towards his radicalism, that he kind of is using Cartesian rationalism to argue himself out of this problem and saying it really doesn't matter what a Jew is. That just doesn't matter.
So Rebecca, I want to change gears here a little to go from his ethics and his connection with his Jewish community to his metaphysics, because we want to compare it briefly with modern science. And you mentioned his devotion to Cartesian rationalism. But both he and Leibniz rejected Descartes' metaphysics. They went very different ways. Leibniz came up, but they both went kind of, well, they went very different ways. Away from the dualism. For Leibniz, the universe ultimately was just a bunch of monads who are minds, I guess. And for Spinoza, it goes from dualism to something that's much more complicated, but there's just one thing. So is there some one thing that they both didn't like about Descartes' metaphysics, which strikes a lot of people as very plausible?
I think that Descartes' rationalism was motivated by his epistemology, his demands for certitude, you know, what it means to ground a belief. He wanted something like mathematics. Spinoza and Leibniz, the heart of their rationalism is metaphysical and not epistemological. It doesn't have to do with knowledge, but their intuitions about the nature of the world. And they both shared the deep intuition, although it took them to different places, that the universe is thoroughly intelligible and that it is an offense to reason to think that there are facts which are just facts for no other reason than they're facts. It was almost it's something that reason can presume, that there's always an explanation. Leibniz called it the principle of sufficient reason, and Spinoza has that same intuition. When you realize that that's what's going on, that he's presuming that, just like a law of logic, those proofs that he gives start to go through. That's the thing that he's assuming there. And where it took him to was that all facts have to be necessary, that causality is a necessary connection. I mean, Hume is really diametrically opposed to Spinoza here, and that the whole shebang has to be self-explanatory. There, to be is to be explicable. It's in reasons all the way down. It's not turtles all the way down. It's reasons all the way down.
And that necessity, one of the things it doesn't leave room for, that relentless necessity, is anything like human freedom, which which is another big thing. But you know, we've got a caller on the line. Phyllis in Menlo Park is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Phyllis.
Oh, thank you. I wanted to briefly mention I love Plato at the Googleplex.
Oh, thank you so much.
Great book. I'm not understanding exactly about what he did believe. Was he anything like a... Oh, first of all, what date was he alive again? Was the 1600s?
Yes, yeah, he was born in 1632, yes.
Okay, you haven't mentioned any influence of the Renaissance on him, or did he have influence on the Renaissance? But what did he believe? Did he have any idea of science or cells or, you know, evolutionary ideas?
He was very interested. So he comes before Sir Isaac Newton, right? So this is very, very early. It's just the beginnings of science. He was very interested in it. He kept... He was in communication with all the scientists of his day. The great astronomer Huygens would only use lenses that ground by, as he called them, our Israelite. And so even after his excommunication, he was still a Jew.
Huygens, as I read somewhere, would only refer to him as that Jew from such and such a place.
Or
that
exactly.
Jew. He would never name him.
Exactly. So that's what I'm saying. It would have been such a good career move to convert to Christianity. But he was very, very interested in science and in optics and the new physics. But, you know, he certainly doesn't know about evolution. I mean, you know, this comes so much later.
He didn't complete modernity. He just started modernity.
Exactly. What he did do is, you know, to say that science can't be dictated to us by rabbis or priests or ministers, you know, so you can imagine him weighing in on the creationism issue. He just said professional thinkers have to be free to think. And that was, as you say, that's the beginning of modernity.
So Rebecca, we know that Einstein was a big admirer of Spinoza and other scientists too. Now, is this because Spinoza was such a great guy, or does his picture of the world really make some contribution or have some deep analogy with the picture offered to us by modern science?
Well, I think both, actually. But the view that if we truly understood the final theory, that there is a final theory, and that it's the only one that's possible, if we could see it, we would know that. This is very attractive to scientists. And, you know, and Stephen Hawking, for example, at the end of A Brief History of Time, his last paragraph is something like, however, if we do discover a complete theory, it should in time be understandable in broad principle by everyone, not just a few scientists. Then we shall all, philosophers, scientists, and just ordinary people, be able to take part in the discussion of the question of why it is that we and the universe exist. If we find the answer to that, it would be the ultimate triumph of human reason, for then we would know the mind of God. That is pure Spinoza.
Yeah, and you know, that's going to be in some long, complicated equation. It's not going to be in ordinary language. But you know, Rebecca, this is a fascinating topic. Spinoza's a fascinating guy, and you are among the most fascinating people I know, and I want to congratulate you on your Humanities Medal. But right now, I have to thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you both.
Our guest has been Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein. She's a prolific author of many works of philosophical fiction and nonfiction. For this purposes, she wrote the book Betraying Spinoza, The Renegade Jew Who Gave Us Modernity. So, John, you want to get any betraying thoughts about Spinoza right now?
Well, I mean, you said you thought the answer to Stephen Hawking's question and thus Spinoza's question would be in a long equation, but I have a feeling I already know the answer, and I can express it in ordinary English, that is, what's human life all about and how did it come to be? By accident. I think if Hawking's looking for more than that out of string theory and the like, he's going to be disappointed. Yeah. But then I'm a mere philosopher. No, what
they're
do
looking,
I know?
They're looking. I mean, look, Spinoza believed in relentless necessity. Every state of the universe follows with necessity upon the previous state and the nature of the universe. There's this equation that will express the eternal essence of the universe and will explain all things. I think that's what modern physics is after.
No, modern physics. I mean, natural necessity, that is, the laws of nature, are deterministic, which I guess we don't really believe anymore anyway, is quite different from rational necessity, which everything makes sense.
That's true.
So I think Spinoza might be a little disappointed.
That's true. Whether you could do that, make natural and rational necessity converge. But you know what? That's a great conversation piece, and this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is Cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. You too can become a partner in that community just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now, a guy who could speed talk his way out of any excommunication trap. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, Spinoza was just 23 when he was excommunicated by a synagogue. Even before that, he'd been attacked on the steps of a synagogue by a knife-wielding man shouting, "Heretic!" He didn't keep his beliefs a secret. He rejected the God of Abraham and religion in general. Why should humans expect rewards or punishments when God is actually the whole universe and therefore not judgy? Maybe it's all been predetermined anyway, God being everything and all. These were heresies, all right, especially for the time. And at the time, excommunication was not that uncommon, not confined to big-ticket transgressions. You could get thrown out for talking too loud, carrying weapons into the synagogue, spreading libel, hanging out with tax avoiders. Now, it didn't seem like it had that big an effect on Spinoza. He was a non-believer anyway. He had friends and admirers and enjoyed his work. Spinoza lived on an allowance provided by friends for him to pursue his studies. He didn't grind lenses as a job, but as research into optics, a new science at the time. Some have wondered why Spinoza did not convert to Christianity after his excommunication. Well, that doesn't make sense. He already doesn't believe in the one thing. Why would he go for Judaism 2.0, now, with Jesus? And surely, if he joined, he would just be kicked out of that church as well. Catholic treatment of heretics was not a cakewalk. Stonings, torture, exile, death. Of course, excommunication is not as bad as it was. Shane O'Connor didn't hurt her much. Napoleon was kicked out. He conquered the world. Who needs the church? Fidel Castro was kicked out, but later had Mass with John Paul II. What about other religions? You can get kicked out of the Lutheran Church, it seems, but it's complicated, involving stating of grievances, discussions of complaints, a vote by the entire congregation. It's an ever-widening circle of shame. The Mormons have excommunication, but it's called disfellowshipping. Jehovah's Witnesses, theoretically, at least, will kick you out just for having lunch with a fornicator. So state your sexual history before you order the tuna melt, I guess. Even the Quakers have a process which is called being read out of meeting. During the Vietnam War, they tried to have Richard Nixon read out, but the Quakers just didn't have the heart to go through with it. Islam does not have excommunication, but it's pretty free with the fatwas, which can lead to shunning, chiding, and, of course, in Salman Rushdie's case, the threat of death. Spinoza was spared all that. Again, he grinded lenses, probably a contributing factor to his death at 44 of an unspecified lung disease, perhaps tuberculosis, perhaps silicosis. Breathing in ground glass fragments all day can't be good for your health. Nowadays, Spinoza's status as a possible victim of unsafe work practices would probably supersede his status as a precursor of modern physics. Posters in the subway trains, billboards, GoFundMe efforts to bring surgical masks to lens crafters, and drafting legislation to force ophthalmologists to put warning labels on nasal passages. Is that the true legacy of Spinoza? Maybe, but maybe his true legacy might be that of Groucho Marx. He wasn't excommunicated, but he did refuse to join any group that would have him for a member. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2018. Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our marketing director is Dave Millar.
Thanks also to Ted Muldoon, Merle Kessler, Erica Topit, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
The other important joke for me is one that's usually attributed to Groucho Marx, but I think it appears originally in Freud's Wit and Its Relation to the Unconscious. And it goes like this, I'm paraphrasing. I would never want to belong to any club that would have someone like me for a member.